1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. It's Feldis and Kale. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers, and Weed Family Automotive, serving the Concord area families' car care needs since 1995, located at 124 Store Street in Concord. Call them at 603-225-7988, or you can find them on the web at weedfamilyautomotive.com. Dan Feldis, great to see you today.
Great to see you.
And Dan just underwent surgery recently, so he won't be able to do any more major league pitching. So his career has come to an abrupt halt.
I was going to be picked up for the playoff run here for a couple teams.
But, yeah, the Red Sox can certainly use some bullpen help, but it won't be you. Our guest today on Feldis and Kale, State Senator Becky Whitley, who represents Concord, Hopkinton, Henniker, and Warner, and that is Senate District 15. And Becky, welcome back to Feldis and Kale.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Ken and Dan.
Thanks for being on. So, Becky, you've done tremendous work in the State Senate on so many issues, including advocating for working families, for high-quality, affordable child care, which is critical, absolutely critical in this pandemic. Let's talk starting there, because, you know, I don't know if people necessarily fully appreciate the consequences of not having high-quality, affordable child care right now and the impact on the workforce, especially women. Can you talk about that and talk about some of the things you've been working on in child care?
Yeah, I think that's right, Dan. So, you know, a lot of working parents knew that access to affordable, quality child care was a big barrier even before the pandemic. But I think what the pandemic has done is brought the issue to the forefront and shown that it's a larger economic issue. So, you know, we are actually getting back to, you know, the similar unemployment rates that we saw before the pandemic, which I guess that's good news, right? But then you look at the actual workforce, and the reality is we don't have enough workers to fill up jobs that we have. And what we are now finding out through a number of different analysis, the Pew Charitable Trust, the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute, the Women's Foundation, they're all saying that one of the reasons why we're having trouble, in addition to low wages, is the fact that we don't have a sustainable child care infrastructure, right? So we don't have enough providers. We don't have enough affordable providers of child care for our workforce to get back to work, right? And so, you know, throughout the pandemic, working parents were certainly drowning, right? They had to deal with remote schooling. They had to juggle work obligations, other family obligations, and we still continue to do that. But what we also saw is that the folks that were leaving the workforce in a larger number were women. And those women are not coming back to the workforce, and in large part because it is because we don't have that availability of child care. It's just a reality that women are continuing to take on more child care responsibilities. You know, and if you look at how much money women are making compared to how much men are making, you know, and you look at your family budget, sometimes it doesn't make sense for the woman to go back to work. So child care is a big piece of the puzzle here. I think that a lot of folks knew it was a problem. It's only exacerbated by the pandemic. So if we don't get our hands around that, we're not going to get the economic growth that we want to see, and we're also not going to, you know, achieve the gender equity that we want to see in the workforce also. So look, we're getting a ton of money from the Fed. We have a federal delegation that is committed to targeted aid for working families, targeted aid to child care. But in New Hampshire, we have to figure out how to spend that money in a way that really works for New Hampshire families and the New Hampshire child care infrastructure. So because of that, we knew this past session that there was going to be a lot of federal money coming in. So what we did was gather folks, you know, child advocates, child care providers, all sorts of folks together. So what can we do at the state level to get the state ready for this money? Where are those points that we can make a real change at the state house? So in New Hampshire, we have a child care scholarship program. So this is a program that supports working families to get back to work. It's a critically important program for our lower income families so they can get back to work. And so the child care scholarship, this should have been a session where we were increasing money that went into the child care scholarship and bolstering that program, but instead the Republican majority went the opposite way. They cut funding to the child care scholarship funding, the child care scholarship program, which was, you know, I have to say, you know, this budget, you know, that passed recently, you know, you look at where those priorities were, you know, budgets are the ultimate test of values. And look, there were lots of tax cuts for wealthy grantstaters, large out-of-state corporations, and working families, they got scrapped. And this is one of the areas where you can really see that in black and white. There was a reduction to the child care scholarship program. In addition, we tried to take a look at how child care providers were reimbursed in this program. So for my child, when he was in child care, I paid on an enrollment basis. So he was in child care 3 days a week. The child care provider got that reimbursement, you know, regardless of whether he was there. But in the child care scholarship program, again, these are for our low-income families, those providers get paid a different way. They only get paid if the child is actually attending. So that means if a child has a runny nose, if you know, maybe a sibling is sick and they have to stay home to quarantine, that means that the child care provider didn't get paid. So that doesn't make a lot of sense, particularly for our child care providers that are operating on a very, very slim margin, right? There's no, if you think about it business-wise, it makes no sense for them. They don't have any predictability. Plus, they're already not getting a lot of money to support these families anyway. So a simple change that we tried to get across the finish line last session was just to change the reimbursement for these child care providers. We heard that it would provide some important sustainability for the infrastructure, and it would help families to have more predictability. Unfortunately, that bill got retained. But I got to say, coming up in the next few weeks, we have an opportunity to get that bill across the finish line. So something to keep an eye out. That is Senate Bill 144. We're going to be working on it in Senate Health and Human Services. And look, this is not a money issue. We now have floods of federal money coming in to fix this. So you're going to see, you know, whether the Republican majority wants to help working families or they don't. This is not an issue of money. The money's there. We just got to get it done.
So one estimate from Save the Children, when we had Save the Children on previously, was that New Hampshire received, this is preliminary estimates, but New Hampshire was set to receive about $72 million in child care help and support.
Yeah.
I guess the question is what is HHS, because it flows through Health and Human Services, what has HHS gotten out the door to what, and what is still being retained, and what are they thinking about doing with it, and is even any of that transparent?
So to the last question, I don't think it is very transparent. So the money came in for child care in different buckets. Some of it went directly to child care providers. I think that you know, didn't get out the door as fast as we wanted to do. So that's one bucket of money. But there's also a huge tranche of discretionary dollars. So that money, we don't know what the plan is, honestly. We have really sort of tried to figure out how the state is going to use this huge tranche of discretionary child care dollars, and we just don't know. They don't have a plan for it. And so, you know, knowing that this is an emergency situation for families and for child care providers, this small solution would have a big impact. It's something that's supported by providers, advocates, all sorts of folks, just simply changing the reimbursement. And look, it's totally permitted for us to use the money this way. It is, there has been guidance from the feds about how to use this child care discretionary dollars. Not only is this a permissible use, but it's actually encouraged. So we just need to we need to get it done. And it would be a transparent way to use these discretionary dollars, something that the advocates put forward, the providers put forward, and not something that's sort of happening behind closed doors.
So $72 million, obviously a lot of money to spend, but what are some of the other areas that it could possibly go toward?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ken. So I think childcare providers are also telling us that, you know, it's impossible for them to keep workers, right? And so that is in large part due to, you know, this, again, this razor thin margin that they are operating on to provide these services. You know, to our kids, these are, you know, these are our most precious grand staters. This is the future of our state, right? So shouldn't we be providing them the highest quality early education and childcare as possible? Because look, childcare is also early education. We, you know, we sort of colloquially call it childcare, but in reality, this is early education brain building, right? And there's so much evidence that if we support families and children in these early years, 0 to 5, we're going to get much better outcomes. These kids are going to do better in school. They're going to have, you know, better access to higher paying jobs. So, you know, this is a situation where, you know, this is going to, you know, if we support these children, they're going to get better outcomes. So what we are hearing is that the workers in the childcare sector, they don't make a lot of money, right? And so shouldn't this be a place where we're investing in the workforce, in that workforce that's taking care of our children? So that's another use of the funds that folks in the childcare sector are really, really pushing for. Let's get these folks, you know, credentialed in a way that they're a high-quality workforce and they're getting paid to do that work.
Our guest today is State Senator Becky Whitley, representing Concord, Hopkinton, Henniker, and Warner. And Becky, you know, as we've mentioned many times on this program, you know, the money that goes toward childcare certainly has a trickle down effect on the rest of the economy, because it puts, you know, a lot of people either back to work or to start working, especially women in many cases, and well, could have a profound effect on our economy if, you know, keeping restaurants and other businesses alive and well.
That's right. You hit the nail on the head. I think folks are seeing that if we're going to get our, you know, workforce back to work, you know, a lot of folks love to go out to eat, and they're realizing, look, I got to wait for my table. I got to wait for my food. You know, there are other service industry. The service industry is incredibly important in New Hampshire. And a lot of those folks aren't going back to work. And there, you know, look, there's compounding factors here. There's safety issues. You know, folks are concerned with, you know, their health, right? The health of themselves and their families. They, you know, that's part of it too. But again, to get folks back to work, they need a safe, reliable childcare setting so that they can do that. So we're not going to move our economy forward. We're not going to get to the place we want to be in New Hampshire unless we figure this issue out.
And Becky, one of the things that I think within the childcare sphere, that talk about childcare providers operating on tight margins, working families are also operating on tight margins too. And as you noted, and part of that is all woven together in terms of what happens when there's some kind of required shutdown of a given daycare room or maybe an entire facility due to a COVID concern. And a lot of families pay up front in a prepaid package for childcare services, and regardless of what happens with respect to COVID, they're out of pocket for that. That in part goes to that legislation you filed, but also it's a larger issue in terms of, you know, this money that's coming in the door. Does that help to offset these costs that are incurred by both childcare providers and families? You know, if you do a prepaid contract and your kid's out for a week because of a COVID concern in a facility, not only do you have to pay that week right now, still have that paid as a parent, but, you know, you're juggling to figure out what the heck you're going to do for that week if you're a working parent. So that discussion about how deep this goes in terms of providing support for those gaps, especially in COVID, I think is critical. And what has been the argument on the Republican side? Because, you know, walking down the street, you talk to Democrats, Republicans, Independents, everybody supporting childcare. But it's elected Republicans for some reason that don't. What is the argument against it?
Yeah, that's a good question. The argument is, let's wait. Okay, and that's what's happened with my legislation, SB 144, you know, which, and you were talking about sort of this, you know, these out-of-pocket costs for families. Not only these upfront contracts, but in this reimbursement situation, if a family does miss a day because they get a child sick, maybe a family member sick, they have to quarantine, because child care providers are operating on this slim margin, sometimes they have to balance bill to the family, right? So families can get surprise bills, right? So that's, again, just another layer here. And the reality is that a lot of folks at the State House, they don't know what it's like to be a working family. They don't know what it's like to be a working parent that's trying to figure out on a day-to-day basis, you know, how to keep their child safe and also, you know, make sure that they're getting the appropriate education. And so a lot of the work is just getting them to understand that this is a problem. I mean, that's how basic we are, right? So what I heard when every time we talked about childcare is, you know, look, we're getting this federal money. Let's just wait. Let's just wait to figure out what's going on. But we can't wait anymore. I mean, the reality is that, you know, we hear a lot of complaints about New Hampshire's workforce and why aren't they getting back to work. But we have some concrete solutions to fix that, Dan, and the Republican majority doesn't want to do it. They don't want to act on it.
Yeah, and you saw the BIA's own survey, the Business Industry Association survey last year, about one of the major reasons of businesses in the state was the absence of affordable and high quality and consistent child care. That's what it is. That is a key component to this whole thing, a key piece to the puzzle in a workforce. I don't think you can say that you're pro-workforce development and pro-attracting and retaining a high-quality workforce and be anti-child care. And right now, the elected Republican majority at the State House is anti-child care.
That's right. I mean, and the business community in New Hampshire really gets that. The BIA gets that. They get that the future of our state depends on, you know, it being an attractive place to live, work, and raise a family. And, like, this basic notion that we know is true, that when New Hampshire children and families thrive, our workforce and our economy prospers, right? And building a more sustainable childcare infrastructure from every sort of think tank, that is one of those basic policies that will support caregivers and get folks back to work. It's central to rebuilding and sustaining our economy. So I think you're right. If you don't support, you know, reforms and sustainability policies for our child care infrastructure, then you're anti-workforce.
So what is it going to take, Becky, to change the minds of some of these people who don't want to spend this money on child care?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the thing is, Ken, it isn't about money at this point. We have the money.
Right.
Money. We just have to get it done. And you know what it's going to take? It's going to take, you know, continued advocacy at the State House and holding our elected officials accountable, right? That important role of citizen that Dan always, you know, speaks so eloquently about. Like, it is the role of, our, you know, people in our communities to hold their officials accountable for these types of issues, to come and share their story. And look, that's why I feel like it's so important to have folks like Dan and government and, you know, other working families in government to share those stories about what it's really like to be a working family right now. And so I'm truly committed to, you know, taking those stories to the State House and making sure they understand what it's actually like to be a working family right now.
Well, certainly, we really appreciate all the work you're doing on this and all your work you're doing generally. We also have a loud dispute and debate, obviously, not just in child care and the state budget, but just a number of components of the state budget. You mentioned tax breaks, additional tax breaks for out-of-state corporations while working families and seniors in New Hampshire are taking it on the chin, and property taxes. Makes no sense to me. Dumb politically, dumb on policy. But there's some other things in there that were controversial, including the first ever abortion ban in the state of New Hampshire was tacked on to the budget. And we're seeing things around the country in terms of attacks on abortion healthcare services. Can you talk a little bit about how that got into the budget? Regardless of your view of abortion healthcare services, why in the world would you just tack that on to the budget? And talk a little bit about some of the other provisions that are in there.
Yeah. So I think the reality is that, you know, the New Hampshire State House has now fallen prey to the incredibly polarizing national politics, all of the culture wars that are sort of meant to divide us. And there were a number of really controversial, extreme partisan issues that were just shoehorned into the budget. And they were shoehorned into the budget because they couldn't get passed on their own. Okay? So they were, they sidestepped the legislative process and they hid it in the budget. And the other thing is that, you know, we have an extreme group of folks in the State House that have, you know, been able to get a whole lot of power, and the Republican majority have gone along with it. So, you know, what there are a few things that were shoved into the budget that weren't able to pass through the regular legislative process. I'll start with vouchers, right? So, you know, vouchers is an issue that we have looked at the State House for many years. It died in the House. It did get through the Senate, and then they tabled it because they wanted to shove it through the budget. So now we have a school voucher program with little to no fiscal analysis. Look, we don't know how much it's going to cost. I don't know how that's fiscally responsible to implement a program that we don't know how much it's going
to
cost.
I don't think the commissioner knows either. And Becky, we have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. We'll pick up with this when we get back. It's an important point, but we'll take a quick break, have a word from our sponsors, and be right back with you.
Sure. 1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. Feldis and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers, and Weed Family Automotive. We welcome them to the show. They've been serving the Concord family needs as far as their vehicles are concerned since 1995 at 124 Store Street. You can call Weed Family Automotive at 225-7988.
And we're back with State Senator Becky Whitley. Becky, before we took the break, we're talking about this voucher scheme, lack of accountability in the process in terms of where the money goes, taxpayer money goes, and whether or not it's going to its intended purpose. Can you talk a little bit more about that and about how this was tacked into the budget after it failed to pass for multiple years, including failing to pass this year in the House? It was just thrown on the back of the budget.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, this voucher program is particularly disturbing to me, as I mentioned, because we don't know how much it's going to cost. So when I talk to people in my community, when I talk to folks all around the state, they say that property taxes, that's their number one issue. Look, we can't afford our property taxes. We have to do something about our school funding situation. And instead of fixing that issue, instead of looking at property tax relief, targeted property tax relief, instead of fixing the education funding system, they tacked on this voucher program that could cost the state, you know, upwards to $70 million. But we don't know. That's the problem. I mean, you know, when this bill went through the legislature, again, it was killed in the House, there wasn't an adequate fiscal analysis. And so how do we tack something onto a budget where we don't know how much it's going to cost our communities? So regardless about how you feel about the idea of school choice, the idea of vouchers, this is a fiscally irresponsible program that will very likely raise the property tax bills of Granite Staters. So that's a problem. And then what happened is that they wanted to get it started before the school year, so they rushed the process through rulemaking. So they have now implemented a program through interim rules with little fiscal accountability, little accountability to protect the rights of students and families that are taking advantage of these programs, and with almost complete discretion given to a private scholarship organization. You know, and the discretion given to this organization is very broad, and I think should be concerning for all folks that care about government accountability. So, and the other thing, Dan, that it's important to mention that went into the budget is this idea of banning divisive concepts. So, you know, there was a lot of talk over the past year about, you know, how do we as a nation and as a state, you know, look at the idea of systemic racism. So this is the session where we should have had an honest conversation about how to address those issues in New Hampshire and move forward to be more united. But instead, we went in the opposite direction, okay? So in the State House, again, this sort of national serious debate over critical race theory seeps into our state budget. So again, a bill that could never pass the full legislature, was shoved into our budget. A so-called prohibition on teaching discrimination is merely political doublespeak, right? It has nothing to do with discrimination. It has to do with banning speech in our schools.
Yeah, and I just, it's just shocking. You know, you have, and in response to that, by the way, and the governor signing that, you saw a strong majority of his diversity council just resigning because they had told him this is antithetical to promoting discussion about diversity and anti-discrimination. So, you know, to think about that and then think about that provision that was put in there and a sub-provision that says that teachers can actually lose their license, lose their teaching license, or get it suspended if they teach or allow to be taught in their class issues surrounding discrimination.
Yeah.
That is wild. And that is bullying at an extreme level. Bullying teachers, threatening them with their own livelihood, to for them to talk about key issues in our society. I just, this seems like a flat out, not just a flat out attack on the issue of discussing discrimination, Becky. It seems like an attack on public schools and public school teachers.
That's right. And, you know, as a parent, you know, shouldn't we be modeling democracy for our students in school? Shouldn't school be a place where, you know, teachers are free to have really honest and open conversations with students? That's the place where we should be modeling democracy. And it's just so, you know, shocking that the live free or die state, something that we're so proud of, is now a place where we're policing topics of conversation in school by teachers with our students. It's also a place now that we are looking to silence conversations rather than debate it on the merit. Look, we don't all disagree. You know, we don't all agree about everything. We're going to disagree, and that is healthy, right? Healthy disagreement is the foundation of democracy. But now we are silencing conversations rather than debating them on the merit, right? So, you know, this budget was the most regressive we have ever seen for free speech in New Hampshire. And, you know, sort of the last thing to mention, that it was the most regressive we have ever seen for women's rights in New Hampshire. As you mentioned at the top, we now, through the state budget, have the first abortion ban in New Hampshire in modern history, right? And so regardless of how you feel about access to reproductive health, there is no place for an abortion ban in the New Hampshire state budget. That's a problem.
Yeah, and on top of that, you have this provision that mandates, in many cases, invasive ultrasounds for those abortions that remain legal. Mandated ultrasounds. I mean, this is, talk a little bit about that and talk about, I mean, this, I think this is the same thing that bubbles up in the South in legislatures. And somehow this was put in without a public hearing, by the way, put in without a public hearing, tacked onto the budget. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is important to point out because, you know, this wasn't discussed in any sort of legislative hearing. So the abortion ban part of the budget, that was discussed in a hearing, right? The full legislature did not get to vote on the bill, but particularly this ultrasound requirement, we didn't get to vote on that. So in addition to banning abortion at a certain amount of weeks, this budget also requires mandatory ultrasound for any woman seeking an abortion, even if it's not medically necessary. Look, this is not this is not something that is required. So, you know, most pregnant women know that you will get an ultrasound, but that ultrasound usually occurs, you know, on your stomach, right? But now, very early in pregnancy, right, if a woman is seeking an abortion, they will have to have a mandatory ultrasound, and that will be transvaginal, right? So they, even if it's not medically necessary, a woman will now be forced to go into an exam room, have a transvaginal ultrasound, even if it's not medically necessary, and she doesn't want it. And that was required in the state budget. And it's appalling, and it's scary. And as a woman, I just can't believe that that the Republican majority thought that this was appropriate to put into a state budget.
And what exactly, for listeners, what exactly to be, you know, to lay it out, a lot of women would be forced into this situation. What exactly is a transvaginal ultrasound?
Right, and so what it means is that, you know, it's a wand, right? And you're going into an exam room, and you're being, it's a forcible transvaginal ultrasound, right? Not on top of your stomach. It's a very invasive procedure that isn't medically necessary. So we're forcibly, inserting a vaginal wand into a woman when it's not necessary, right? And let's think about those women that are seeking an abortion, right? And women, you know, seek this type of reproductive care for a lot of different reasons. And in my opinion, that's none of our business. But there are some women that seek access to abortion very early on because of a very traumatizing incident, whether it's sexual assault, whether it's, you know, incest. You know, even in those situations, those women who have already experienced an incredibly traumatizing sexual assault, they will also be forced to have a transvaginal ultrasound if they seek an abortion in this state. Mandatory.
I just think that this is just outrageous. And I think the more people learn about it, the more outraged they become. And I think the more people learn about other elements of the budget, the more outrageous, they become. You know, I think this budget passes basically in the middle of the summer. Pretty much when people are going on vacation. And, you know, I think it just requires, as you mentioned, Becky, earlier on, it requires citizens to be active and engaged and to learn. And, you know, if this is what you want, then you could reelect the current elected Republican majority. But I think most Republicans, Democrats and independents don't want the type of stuff that was put into this budget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. And, like, you know, you can sort of think about the invasive nature of these restrictions and these requirements, right? You know, certainly for women, it's this bodily invasion. But I think there's also this other piece to it. It's like the significant sort of financial and logistical burden. And, like, you have to think about this notion of individual freedom in New Hampshire that we're so proud of. So this requirement, like, is there any legitimate justification or sort of government interest that New Hampshire has in burdening all women seeking abortions to have this ultrasound? Is there any legitimate state interest in doing that? No, there's none. So the only justification for this mandatory requirement, is to impede access to reproductive health care. And I think that's, you know, something that we really want to think about in New Hampshire. And then sort of going to the abortion ban that was in the budget, you know, this abortion ban, you know, I think that the Republican majority and Governor Sununu has been trying to, frankly, spread some misinformation about it, right? And this governor has said, I'm a pro-choice governor. But the reality is that a pro-choice governor does not sign an abortion ban. And, you know, the stories that were told to the Senate Judiciary Committee during the hearing on this bill were devastating. So a woman who would be seeking an abortion at 24 weeks or after, those women are women who have pregnancies that are very much wanted, right? These are pregnancies where maybe a nursery is already in place. This is a very much wanted pregnancy, but maybe they go to one of their appointments, maybe a 21, 22-week appointment, and maybe they get this news, right? We heard from women that they're going to these appointments. They get news that the fetus, the pregnancy, is not compatible with life, okay? So under this new abortion ban, a woman who has a pregnancy with a fetus that is not compatible with life, meaning that fetus will not survive when it's born, they will now be forced to carry that pregnancy to term. That's just cruel to me. So, you know, when you hear a governor saying he's pro-choice, but he's going to force a woman to carry a pregnancy like that, that's not pro-choice. To me, that's cruel. And so our abortion ban is extreme in its lack of exceptions. We do not have an exception for that situation that I just described, a fatal fetal diagnosis. It also criminalizes doctors. So we heard from provider after provider saying, you are going to destroy the obstetric field in New Hampshire. We are not going to be able to get providers to our state if we're going to criminalize our doctors for providing access to reproductive health care. Right. So regardless of, you know, what they heard, the Republican majority still pushed this through, criminalizes doctors, lack of exceptions, and a mandatory ultrasound. You know, we need to dig down deep here and go beyond just words and see, you know, how our governor and our Republican majority are taking action. And they're taking action to remove access to reproductive health care for half of our population.
Our guest today on Feldes and Kale, State Senator Becky Whitley. We'll take a quick break and wrap it up with Senator Whitley. After these words, our program is sponsored by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local dairy farmers and Weed Family Automotive of Concord. 1039 1450 WKXL and HTalkRadio.com. Feldes and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And Weed Family Automotive, 124 Store Street in Concord. Our guest, State Senator Becky Whitley, who represents Concord, Hopkinton, Henniker, and Warner. And Senator Whitley, what do you look forward to accomplishing in the next and upcoming legislative session?
Yeah, so, you know, we have a real opportunity yet again to, you know, provide some real relief to working families and those folks that were impacted the most by the pandemic. So, you know, I'm hopeful that we can really get something done on the child care side. You know, that bill was retained. We have an opportunity to really listen to grant staters and get that done on the child care side. Look, we also know that, you know, folks in New Hampshire are still struggling with making sure they have enough food to eat. We have, you know, a food stamp program that's federally funded, SNAP program. We have really low enrollment. You know, we know that there's a great need, but folks don't know that this benefit is available. So, you know, in my opinion, a civilized society shouldn't have any hungry people. And so, you know, we're looking at our SNAP program in New Hampshire, seeing if we can expand outreach to make sure that everyone who is eligible knows they're eligible. Look, we also have a lot of work to do to make sure that, you know, the child protection system is adequate and that we have all those preventions in place to prevent child abuse and neglect. A lot of work that Dan did in the Senate to make sure that our children and families are protected. You know, there's still work to be done on that. That's a bipartisan issue, and I think we can get that done. Some other things that I think are important to think through are, you know, we need to look at, you know, sort of the availability of remote access to the legislative process. So the last session during COVID, you know, we saw that families, you know, working people were able to access the legislative process because of remote access. This year we are seeing a hesitance from the Republican majority for that kind of access. So we need to make sure that folks have access to the legislative process. You know, the other thing we need to look at is we need to repeal a lot of stuff that happened last session. We are going to work to repeal this abortion ban. We're going to look to repeal the divisive concept law. So there's a lot of work to be done to undo a lot of what was done last session.
And Becky, in addition to all of that, obviously this is a redistricting year. The census data came out a few weeks ago or so. And do you have any confidence in the current elected Republican majority conducting a fair, open, and transparent redistricting process, number one? And number two, given that, you know, those independent bipartisan redistricting processes have been vetoed by Governor Sununu. Do you have any confidence in his leadership to make sure it's fair, open, transparent, and the maps are drawn based on the data, not the politics, so that politicians don't pick their voters? It's the other way around. Do you have any confidence in the process right now?
So No, unfortunately I don't. So, you know, I think just going back to the importance of having redistricting be a transparent process. Why is that important? You know, redistricting can sort of seem like kind of this boring, you know, behind closed door process, but it's incredibly important because this is the point where we're drawing the line, right, about, you know, that are going to be in place for the next 10 years. And so I think most people can agree that it's more appropriate, right, or it's not appropriate for politicians to be choosing who are going to vote for them, right? That's not what most people think, right? And so that's why for many, many years, there has been a bipartisan push to get an independent redistricting commission. And Dan's right, the governor vetoed that. So that means, you know, he is willing to support the closed door drawing of lines. And that only supports the folks in power to keep their power, right? To continue to gerrymander states in a way that allows them to stay in power. So, you know, I'm really concerned that those, yet again, another decade, the Republican majority will draw those lines behind closed doors in a way that allows them to stay in power, right? And I will say that the Democrats, you know, were the ones that were really pushing for this independent redistricting commission, even when they were in power.
Yep, so that's right.
Yeah. And so I think that's really important. And, you know, the governor vetoed that. So, you know, we are still waiting to hear in the Senate what that's going to look like. But we do know in the House that they are doing everything possible to get those lines drawn behind closed doors. So I think it's important for everyone to pay close attention to what is happening with redistricting. What are those politicians doing? Is this a fair process? Who has access to these maps? Does everyone have access to these maps? Are we going to be able to look at the maps before they are in place to provide comments on them, for the public to provide comments on them? It's an incredibly important process that we have to keep our eye on.
Senator Becky Whitley, we appreciate you being with us, and have fun in the next legislative session.
Thanks so much, Ken and Dan. I really appreciate the time.
Take care, Becky.
All right.
Take care.
1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Feldes and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers, and Weed Family Automotive of Concord. Welcome back. 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Feldes and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers, and Weed Family Automotive, located at 124 Store Street in Concord. You can give them a call at 225-7988. And today, as we record this program, September 7th, 2021, it's National Neither Snow Nor Rain Day.
So far, it's true.
That's true. It's a day to honor and pay tribute to U.S. postal workers.
Yes. And you know, look, they do yeoman's work. You know, rain, snow, shine, it doesn't matter what it is. And also with some of these attacks on the Postal Service, they've plowed right through and continue to work hard and deliver the mail. Thank your postal carrier next time you see him or her.
Absolutely. The first Postmaster General of the United States was Benjamin Franklin.
He did a lot of different things.
He did. He was a very versatile guy, you know.
About it. Yeah. A lot of good quotes.
Utility
too.
Infielder, too, I understand.
He was. Relief pitcher, too.
That was in 1775 when the American Revolution was taking place. And in 1847, the first postage stamps were issued. 1847.
Wow.
And in 1863, during the Civil War, free city delivery began in the city, but the rural delivery began in 1896. So that's when rural delivery.
The Pony Express.
The Pony Express, right. And the airmail. You know when airmail started, Dan?
I don't.
No, I didn't either.
I think you're going to tell me that.
I am. 1918. Wow. They started airmailing in 1918. And in 1963, the zip code was inaugurated. 1963.
The zip code in 63. That sounds about right.
There you go. Well, that's
a wrap.
That's a wrap.
We'll zip it up there.
On this, yes, there you go. That does it for this edition of Feltus and Kale. I hope we delivered a good program for you today here on 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. Join us next time for Feltus and Kale, brought to you by Granite State Dairy Promotion and Weed Family Automotive.